My stay in Locarno proved a welcome respite from the heavy lecture schedule. The French windows in my hotel room opened to a small balcony. It was peaceful to sit on the balcony in a soft, easy chair, to lean back and enjoy the panorama of lake and mountain scenery. There was time to consider the many events of previous weeks. The true significance of what I had witnessed became clear to me. For instance, what happened to the money changers Christ drove out of the temple? It seems as though they have gathered over the centuries in Zurich. Of course, this comparison is allegorical, but the results are apparent. Zurich, financial center of the world, is the international headquarters for the Silence Group. The invisible reins of financial influence extend from Zurich to puppet organizations in every nation. Has it ever occurred to the reader that every nation is financially linked to the Bank of Switzerland, in the country which has enjoyed complete neutrality during every world conflict? Geneva is a gigantic chessboard where nations of the world are played one against the other, according to the dictates of what the Swiss themselves term the colossal financiers. All of this is accomplished under the cloak of neutrality, in Switzerland, where wars are not permitted to happen. During my tour, I had succeeded in alerting too many people to the truth. The overlords cannot tolerate people who think for themselves. That is why suppression of knowledge is necessary to the success of a dictatorship. People who think for themselves are difficult to control, because the minute they realize they are being exploited, they begin to search for truth and freedom. The only way the Silence Group could combat me was to discredit me before the public. If it had not been for the assistance of my friends from other planets, the Silence Group would have achieved its aim. Women are not permitted to vote in some regions of Switzerland. This issue came up for vote while I was there, but the bill was defeated. The reason is clear: now that I have witnessed the invisible world government in action, they could not afford to have women interfere with their absolute monarchy. It has often been said that the hand that rocks the cradle controls the destiny of the nation. In my home country, the USA, women enjoy equal rights, as do the women of other planets, and they have joined their men as equal partners in the journey toward a more harmonious civilization. I sat on the balcony and thought again of the widespread mysticism that has been falsely applied to the visitors from other planets. The fraudulent mystic groups, professing to be in psychic contact with the space people, have aided the Silence Group immensely. They have caused confusion and kept the entire space program in a state of ridicule. A public information officer of the United States Air Force once told me that if it had not been for the psychic cultists, the governments could have made their knowledge public long ago. I hope someday the psychics realize they are holding back the very knowledge they desire. 6. End of the tour. On June 12, 1959, accompanied by Mrs. Luzenstag, I left Switzerland for Rome, Italy. Her presence proved invaluable, since she could speak and understand both English and Italian and could act as interpreter. Furthermore, she was personally acquainted with both of our co-workers in Rome, neither of whom were too familiar with the English language as spoken by Americans. At the airport, we were met by Dr. Alberto Perigo, our first co-worker in Italy, and a group of friends interested in our interplanetary visitors and what they have to teach us. En route from the airport, we were driven through Old Rome on a portion of the ancient road constructed in 312 BC, giving us a graphic view of the days when Roman legionnaires marched along this stone-paved thoroughfare. On account of my health, no lectures were scheduled for me in Italy. This was a pleasure trip which I expected to enjoy to its fullest. I enjoyed too meeting our co-workers and many friends who had written to me through the years. People, I found, are pretty much the same wherever you find them: friendly, kind, generous, with an appreciation of pleasures of many kinds. The greatest dividing line, it seems to me, is the differences in languages, which prevents us from being able to thoroughly understand one another. Rome is a beautiful city, but when I passed through the ancient Colosseum, I seemed to grow sick and cold, for I could sense a reenactment of the days when men were tortured within this great amphitheatre. The agonies of those early martyrs seemed to be impressed in the very stones enclosing the arena. Most of June 13 was occupied in exploration of the ancient structures, and in taking motion pictures of these historic remnants. The following day a small, private dinner party was given in my honor at the Ristorante La Sistina. The food here was delicious. I was fascinated by the place and its surroundings, the style of clothing worn by the waiters, as well as by their manner of serving. An atmosphere of cordiality and gaiety prevailed which proved both refreshing and relaxing. I enjoyed every moment that we were there, a matter of several hours. After we had finished eating and were ready to leave, we decided not to call a taxi. After such a large meal, we all agreed that a little exercise would do us good. A very impressive and beautiful sight lay before us in all directions as we walked leisurely down streets brightly lighted by indirect flood lamps, beamed on ancient ruins. It was midnight when we finally reached a main thoroughfare. Now, we decided, would be a good time to take a taxi, but not one could be found. I was not at all familiar with the streets of Rome, but when my host suggested that we turn in a certain direction, I said, "Oh, no. Taxicana straight ahead." Where such a word for taxi came from, I shall never know. These friends who had so honored me understood little or no English, nevertheless my unexpected comment was a cause for laughter by all. As we reached the next corner in the direction I had suggested, suddenly, out of nowhere, a taxi pulled up. The driver jumped out, and opened the door. Surprised though we were, we entered. When we gave the name of our hotel, the driver asked, "Americano?" I answered, "Yes." Then, instead of driving us directly to the hotel, the driver proceeded to take us on a scenic tour of Rome that lasted until nearly daybreak before he finally drew up before the hotel. Every moment of the trip had been most enjoyable. A night I shall never forget. Naturally, we expected to be charged for the extended ride, but the driver refused to accept extra fare money. "No extra charge," he said. "I am glad to do it for the American. I have often wondered, since that night in Rome, who was the cab driver? How did he happen to come along at the right moment, in that particular place? How did he recognize me as an American, when so many people have taken me for an Italian, or of Spanish origin?" Although no lectures had been scheduled for me, Dr. Perigo had arranged to speak to a large group of people, including many from the ranks of the military and the church. His talk was excellent, and well received. I was particularly interested in this meeting, and wanted to personally get the feel of the people. For this reason Mrs. Zinstag, one of my hosts of the dinner party, and I attended, sitting in the back of the auditorium. The speaker, of course, knew that we would be there. So, at the close of his talk, he announced my presence, and asked me to come to the platform that I might answer questions from the audience. I arose, and as I walked down the aisle, people started cheering, and many of those seated along the edge of the aisle reached out to shake my hand. After the unpleasant publicity I had been given and the reactions in Zurich, I was almost overwhelmed by this friendly heartfelt greeting. I shall never forget it. When the question period was over, another ovation began. One priest arose and said, "Thank you, brother, for the information that we have received." Sincere appreciation for my answers was expressed, and for the opportunity to ask questions. Dr. Francesco Palimeni, the other of our co-workers in Rome, is a professional pressman who has traveled considerably. Much of his lifetime has been spent in seeking the underlying causes behind world events. I enjoyed a short visit in his home, where he and his wife were able to give me a great deal of knowledge regarding unpublished facts that paved the road for conditions as we find them today between nations. Their reports were without emotion or prejudice, of conditions they had personally seen and experienced along with thousands of other people. To me it was most interesting, as well as an added proof of how the people of the world are being kept in ignorance of true conditions by those who know they cannot rule a well-informed public. All too soon my wonderful vacation in Italy came to an end. I had only visited Rome, but every moment had been filled with interest. I was beginning to feel better, although still not up to my normal strength. On June 17, 1959, I left Rome by plane for Denmark, where I was to change in Copenhagen for a polar flight to Los Angeles. Captain H. C. Peterson, our co-worker in Denmark, was unable to get to the airport while I was there, but sent two very friendly and well-informed young men to represent him. Here again I wished there had been more time for me to spend with those friends who did meet me and were so sincerely interested in our interplanetary visitors and the purpose behind their coming. The polar night, with its perpetual daylight and monotonous expanses of ice and snow, was another new experience for me. To combat the ice glare, the shades in the passenger lounge were drawn, and we were given blindfolds. In Greenland we made a short refueling stop at a drab, isolated military base. Winnipeg, Canada, was our next and last refueling stop before arriving in Los Angeles, California. Here I went through final customs. A change of planes here, and I was on my way to San Diego and home, my world tour completed. Many times since then I have reviewed the events of those 6 months. I believe the truth was brought to many people of the world, as requested by our space brothers. Yet, to this day I am deeply concerned that the silence group and other selfish interests might continue to hinder our progress. One thing is certain, the most powerful instrument in the hands of the silence group is public apathy. The man who does not care that other friendly humans exist on planets around us is most easily misled by the selfish interests, and unwittingly serves as a tool for the silence group. 2. Those who resent expenditures of public funds for outer space research, preferring vast sums for destructive purposes, are, knowingly or otherwise, contributing to the total destruction of life on this planet. Book 3, 1. Satan, Man of the Hour. Satan, Man of the Hour, was published by me in 1937 as a small brochure. A few minor changes have been made to bring the subject matter up to date and fitting to present day conditions. Lucifer is symbolic of the mortal sense mind. Out in the infinite vistas of space, in the midst of billions of whirling planets and brilliant suns, mere dots in the limitless expanse of the whole, existed the presence of harmony in perfect equilibrium. The cosmos was at peace throughout its entirety when suddenly some intangible sense of impending disaster seemed to pass through the vastness like a fleeting shadow form. A sardonic chuckle slipped out across the ether waves of space, striking an uncanny awe in the heart of every living thing. The calm, lingering movements of the cosmic clouds changed to a seething, rolling chaos. Earth planets shook as with a mighty ague. Giant suns became volcanic in their nature and belched forth great masses of fiery vapor. Thunderous vibrations shook the heavens and lightning flashed on a scene of war, a battle of the forces. Again that taunting laugh reverberated through the cosmos, and a deep ringing voice so mighty in its tone that it seemed to dominate and hold in breathless silence all lesser vibrations in the span of infinity spoke to the presence of the Most High. O God of the mighty cosmos, come forth now and prove your dominion. I, Lucifer, defy your authority. I have usurped your power. I am the greatest force in the universe. You have set your spies upon me and I have deceived them with a mock humility until I should have grown strong enough to openly challenge you. What have you to say, O God? Do you acknowledge me as your superior? The incredible stillness that now gripped the body of infinity seemed, in its very act of insistent calmness, to combat the fiery thunderous voice of defiance. And then, as though proceeding forth on soft fluttering wings of light came the almost inaudible message, Lucifer, great archangel, the pride of power within you has blinded you to that law to which we both are subject, that which exalts itself shall be cast down, and so not I but law shall answer you. Hereafter you shall be known as Satan. No more shall the mansions of space nor the heavenly hierarchies know your presence. You shall be confined to the regions of Earth. The power you have shall not be taken from you but your field of action shall be limited, for you shall, henceforth, dwell among those Earth children of mine who still are faithful to me. You shall be as one of them until you have learned the meaning of the humility you mocked, and are willing to reunite with me and work as one. The gentle, fluttering tone vibration ceased, and each atom in space seemed to be held in quiet expectancy. Then, like a tremendous force torn from within the circle of everlasting cosmic light, one aspect of that mighty twin infinity shot downward through space. The law had spoken, Lucifer had become a prisoner of Earth, sentenced by a just decree. But suddenly this force became a thought vibrating back through the celestial regions with a deep and sinister tone of mockery. O foolish god and god of fools, to trust the loyalty of earthly men. Here shall I reign and teach these children of thine ways of power and self-exaltation. The spring of 1960 dawning upon the scene of economic, political and social dissemination found also the minds of the world inhabitants filled with vague wonderings. The air was filled with talk of strikes, war and want. Every man was deeply concerned with the ever-increasing civil and international complications. In the lounge room of a well-known mountain tavern, where innumerable nerve-worn, world-weary individuals retire to seek a few hours' release from the grueling grind of commercial and social activities, sat a group of men, recently engaged in the momentous task of verbally solving the world's problems. A gathering representing in a small way the life of the world, a great captain of industry, a young army officer on leave, a well-known minister whom an adoring congregation had seen fit to release from duty and finance to a much-needed rest, a scientist who had stolen away to the alluring peace of this mountain retreat where he might, while working on his latest book, commune with terrestrial nature which he must understand thoroughly in his work with the elements. There was also a jaded bookkeeper from one of the large packing houses, trying intense short days to absorb enough beauty and freedom and peace to carry him through another year's confinement within an artificially illumined cage. The hour of midnight was approaching. The great logs in the fireplace crackled and sputtered, but the playing fingers of flame had worked their magic of relaxation, and a lull had come in the conversation. The whistling of a rising wind through the eaves lent an added feeling of security and peace to those well-sheltered individuals who shared the comforts of the tavern lounge. Suddenly, intruding itself upon their dreamy meditation, came spoken words in tones of supreme compassion: poor mortal slaves, shackled and bound by a force they neither know nor understand. The eyes of the five men turned simultaneously toward the sound of the voice and rested with frank inquiry upon the newcomer who had silently joined them. They knew not when. H.C. sat slightly apart, partially obscured in shadow. Slaves? The question was almost as unanimous as the turning of heads had been when the man's voice had first pierced the stillness. The strange rose now, leisurely, as though he had absolved time of all responsibility in his life, and strolled toward the open fire where he stood for several moments in silent contemplation, apparently disregarding the question. Yet his very sense of poise and calm assurance seemed to demand, without a tinge of aggression, the unwavering attention of these fellow beings. At last he spoke. "I couldn't help overhearing your conversation. You were discussing the interesting question of who's who in the world. You had come to no agreement as to the identity of the outstanding man of the hour, that dominating figure of the present age whose finger is upon the control switch of the political, social and economic machinery of the world. Shall I tell you who he is, you who are all slaves to him?" The five men of the world were so taken aback by this abrupt monologue that they neither spoke nor as much as gestured the affirmative answer they would have given. The stranger's vision rested upon each one in turn, rested not upon the surface of their being, but seemed to penetrate to the very soul of each and draw out of him, as the gaze was withdrawn, the deepest secrets of the individual's life. At last his voice, calm as before, yet carrying a hint of thunder in its tone, jolted them out of their momentary state of lethargy. "Satan, my friends. Satan is the man of the hour." The tension was immediately released, and each of the men permitted himself the privilege of a smile. Here, surely, was another religious devotee turned fanatic by a too intense concentration upon one channel of thought. "You are a member of the clergy?" ventured the captain of industry. "No," denied the stranger. "I am merely a student of universal action. I am an observer of nature's laws and their manifestation in the various degrees of expression." "Well, whatever you are, you have undoubtedly given us an unexpected answer to the question at hand, but, without the slightest intention of offense, let me say that I do not think many men of today place much belief in that picturesque figure of a somewhat ancient mythology. If you will allow me to lapse into a bit of modern slang, We have given Satan the go-by, and in the meantime old Satan is giving you the runaround," said the stranger with a quick twinkle of amusement in his eyes. Then, as suddenly turning again to a serious mood, he continued, "Do not misunderstand me, my friends, I am not referring to that much characterized individual dressed in red tights, with a pitchfork in his hand. I refer to a force, an aggressive force that is predominant in the average human mind today, a force that has become personnel in working through so many millions of personal channels. The power of selfishness and greed which Satan represents has become so generally expressed through humankind today that we might easily speak of it as one individual being. The desire for power, personal gratification and self-exaltation, has become so great in man that the human race has practically lost sight of those cosmic characteristics which compose its inherent birthright. It is struggling and sweating and cursing beneath the whiplash of its satanic overseer." Here the widely famed minister broke in upon the stranger's discourse. "Don't you think, my friend, that you are putting it a bit too strongly?" he asked. "It is true that the world is in a more or less unsettled condition at the present time, and there seems to be a great deal of evil perpetuated by humankind of today, but that appearance is chiefly due to the fact that the wrongs of man are so generally publicized, whereas the right actions are allowed to rest upon their own merits. Do you not think that the religious element of the world can, with God behind it, gain the victory over this satanic force of which you speak? Right is might, you know. But are you sure you know the right?" The stranger looked directly into the eyes of the minister for the space of several moments and then, with a slight gesture of dissent, replied, "I suppose you believe yourself to be sincere in what you just expressed. You no doubt consider yourself a true prophet, a messenger of God. But even you, you and thousands of other appointed ministers and teachers of truth are actually messengers of Satan. You have perverted the laws of the cosmos even as the so-called criminal element of the world has done. You are teaching not truth but hypocrisy, falsehood and selfishness. Nay, save your remonstrances until I have finished." The stranger interrupted his own thoughts to forestall the defense he saw rising in the minister's mind. "Religion, you say, will lead men out of this chaos. Nay, though you are wrong. Even these angels supposedly sent by God to save his children have been perverted by Satan's suggestion of power, fame, wealth and dominance. They have accepted his bribe of earthly acquisitions, serving heaven but accepting their rewards from earth. It is these perverted angels who have taught the worship of false gods, gods of revenge and anger. It was religion that withheld the right of free thought, crying heresy to the works of scientific minds such as Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler and hundreds of others, instilling in each new generation those long-cherished prejudices that held their great-grandfathers in slavery to Satan. No, religion as it has been taught and practiced stands only as a symbol of oppression. All men are willing to give advice, to preach brotherhood and world unity. But when it comes to living those teachings, they are not able to rise above the satanic thought of self. Thus far will we go and no further. They say, possession is man's god, greed and selfishness his principle of living. If he continues in the path he now travels, this civilization will destroy itself as others have done. No, said the scientist, we have progressed too far. We are daily unveiling the secrets of life. Science is even now able to do everything except put a soul into form. It can create forms and perpetuate life in those forms. It is true that we have not yet been able to give them intelligence with which to act independently, but we are not through. Our research has just begun. We will yet become masters of the elements, masters of life and death. I believe that science will be the savior of this civilization. Yes, replied the stranger. Science has done and is doing much, but even it cannot save these races whose god is temporal power, for, although there are a few men who are working impersonally to benefit the whole of mankind, there are thousands of men who will use the discoveries of those few in the field of perversion. Men are acquiring knowledge but not wisdom. It is one thing to be intelligent, it is another to use intelligence wisely, to control its action. Men today are psychological infants and intellectual giants. The two do not go well together. The marvelous works of science will not forestall mass hysteria which leads to murder and destruction. Science cannot inoculate the entire race against the germ of selfishness as it can against the germ of smallpox. You may learn the secrets of life and death, you may be able to restore the breath to a form, but can you eliminate from that form the fear, the selfishness, the jealousies, envies, greed, hate? Can you instill the sense of absolute brotherhood in the human intellect? No. That is the work of each individual. No one can change the character of a man except that man, himself. He can be taught how to do it, but how shall even this be done when those who guide his moral and psychological progress are themselves dealing in perversions of the cosmic laws, separating man's actions into good and evil according to personal judgment? Men are too prone to regard our present civilization as a permanent reality. Be not so sure, my friends. Other civilizations have come and gone, and to the all-intelligence each one is only so great as a wandering speck of dust that appears to the vision of man for one instant as it passes through a fleeting ray of sunshine. There were races of highly intelligent men upon this planet at one time. In fact, the first perversion of cosmic principle took place in Lemuria, the great land that existed in the Pacific Ocean, connected with what is now the western coast of the United States. It was an Edenic garden where the inhabitants walked the flowery paths of life in a state of perpetual youth. Human and animal life dwelt side by side without a trace of fear. These men were natural beings. They were so united one with another that they could commune by thought rather than oral expression, and so closely attuned to nature that they needed not to ferret out the secrets of chemical action but only to use the gifts this planet had to offer. They were what today would be known as great scientists, intuitive scientists. Then gradually Satan began to insinuate strange ideas into the consciousness of those children that had never known any guidance but that of the Great Spirit. He started them on the path of self-exaltation, the path of division, where at one time they had worked with nature to produce greater beauty merely as a duty of action toward the cosmos, they now acted with a thought of reward to self. They engaged in the work of creating objects to please the senses, likes and dislikes were born. They became self-conscious. Each man tried out his power of creation and everything of beauty that each individual conceived was labeled mine. Vanity and possessiveness stole into the sublimity of their Edenic life, and with the thought of mine and thine came greed. The voice of the stranger seemed to be drifting off, and within the consciousness of each of his listeners arose the living pictures of that ancient land. But now the signs of age seemed to be creeping upon these children of Lemuria, age that eventually led them into knowledge of a mortal death. Years passed as a flash, hundreds of years, and then the film of memory halted at a scene that shall not easily be forgotten. A true and humble teacher stood by a group of his fellow men. His gestures were eloquent of pleading and his words rang out with the vehemence of sincere feeling. My children, he was saying, cannot you see the folly of your ways? Can you not perceive the fact that you are headed for destruction? This land was once a paradise. You were as one happy family sharing the treasures of the Great Spirit's bounty, treasures of peace, of joy, of free expression were yours. You knew no greed, no selfishness, no gross desire for human exaltation. The elements obeyed your command because you governed them unselfishly, recognizing the oneness of all, but now you have lost your holy vision. You have grown to worship those elements that were at one time subject unto you and they have become your master, for that which you worship shall always be greater than yourself. Open your eyes, children of the One Spirit. Purge your hearts of this disintegrating force of separation before you totally destroy yourselves and your land. For 7 months the earth has been trembling. The elements are rising to mastership. Beware lest they turn against you. Even as he spoke, his listeners disrespectfully walked away laughing and chatting. He has grown old, they said, and his mind wanders. He cannot understand progress nor realize that the knowledge of our personal creative power is the stimulus that urges us on to greater things. I, the teacher spoke sorrowfully, to greater greed, to greater selfishness. I could lead you again to the path of peace but you will not have it so. And then suddenly upon this unworthy wilderness of thought, In the midst of this insatiable desire for personal exaltation, the hand of destiny fell. The moving pageant of desire turned to a shrieking chaos as nature sought a long-due readjustment.